you're good to go.
I'll call the House Committee on Healthcare to order for this May 13th. A couple of announcements first. We're going to hold over Senate Bill 233 and Senate Bill 505. Will we reschedule them or hold over till?
Reschedule, please.
We'll reschedule them. We're going to open the hearings in some semblance of order. The committee has a variety of things going on today, so I have to wait till I get enough yes votes on every bill.
Well, not necessarily.
Or not.
You want us to tell you which ones to work, Mr. Chair?
I do. Tell me, Vice Chair. Let's open the public hearing on Senate Bill 298. What do we have, Madam Minister?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 298A comes to you from the Senate with 27 ayes, 1 no, 2 excused. It adds bodywork to the definition of massage, modifies the definition of massage to clarify that massage does not mean the practicing of any form of high-velocity, short amplitude manipulative thrusting procedures provided to the articulations of the spine or extremities. It excludes community colleges and accredited colleges and universities from the definition of massage facility, and it modifies the massage therapist certified hours from 500 to 625. There is no fiscal impact, no revenue impact, Mr. Chair, and we have one individual signed up to testify.
Can you please call him?
David Fredrickson, please, Oregon Board of Massage Therapists.
I have to announce I'm having trouble passing this bill because I can't get everybody on the committee to carry it on the floor and explain that thrusting stuff.
Never fear, Mr. Chairman, I can help you.
I think that's what we're afraid of.
For the committee's information, I'm prepared to address all three or four of these subjects, but in my comments, I'd like to speak specifically to the hourly requirement change.
I'd appreciate it if you comment briefly on all the topics. That would be helpful.
Thank you. Chair Greenlick and members of the House Committee on Health Care, for the record, I am David Fredrickson. I practice clinical massage therapy in Ashland, and I serve as chair of the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists. I'm here today to speak in favor of SB 298A. As a former private massage school owner and as a current educator in the field, I've been keenly interested in the collaborative efforts of the Coalition of Massage Therapy Organizations to identify entry-level educational standards for the massage therapy profession nationwide. The coalition is made up of 7 national leadership organizations representing massage therapy education, massage school accreditation, professional trade associations, and massage therapy regulators. In 2013, the coalition presented the results of an exhaustive 2-year process in 2 documents, one called the Core Entry-Level Massage Education Blueprint and 2 Entry-Level Analysis Project Report. A key focus of the project was to recommend the minimum number of instructional hours massage schools and educators need to prepare students for entry into the profession. Again, this is a nationwide recommendation. The study recommended 625 hours minimum of educational instruction. The state of Oregon currently requires a minimum of 500 hours of educational instruction. The Oregon Board of Massage Therapists supports the minimum core competency standard of 625 instructional hours recommended by the Coalition of Massage Therapy Organizations. Currently, the 12 massage therapy programs in Oregon provide an average of 680 hours of entry-level instruction. As a group, they broadly support the increase of instructional hours in SB 298 to a minimum of 625. Leading public and private massage programs recognize the need to exceed the present Oregon minimum 500 hours to meet the increasing needs of the profession. The healthcare industry demands entry-level massage therapy programs that strengthen core competencies, elevate instruction, and provide clear learning objectives and guidelines. When these demands are met, a primary care provider will recognize the power of evidence-based massage therapy for the treatment of pain, stress, injury, and chronic musculoskeletal conditions. strengthen massage therapy instructional programs better serve the public whose safety the Oregon Board of Massage Therapists seeks to serve and to protect. I ask for your support of SB 298A to help ensure that Oregon remains a national leader in the field of massage therapy education. Would you like me to speak to the other topics?
The other topics, please.
In terms of the high velocity, short amplitude thrust adjusting, the Chiropractic Association and the Chiropractic Board is clear that the treatment with this type of therapy, high velocity, short amplitude thrust adjusting, is the purview of chiropractors and osteopaths. It is not the purview of licensed massage therapists who are not trained to do those adjustings.
You have no problem with that?
None. No, as so defined, no, sir. No, it's very clear. In fact, in terms of compliance issues for the Board of Massage, having that language be as specific is going to help us in terms of compliance issues. In terms of facilities, facilities are defined in rule as private facilities that employ massage therapists. The exclusion of educational facilities would mean that they would not have to apply for a facilities permit in order to conduct massage clinics in their facilities. They are already licensed by the Department of Education, and the state has oversight over their clinics. They do not need an additional permit. And the third, would you remind me?
The third is
the instructional hours, and there was one more.
That was the first. Hold on. I'm trying to look for it.
Body work?
Body work.
That's it.
The redefinition or the clarification of body work in line with massage therapy is to help people in our profession try to delineate what is or is not massage therapy. Increasingly, massage therapy is being more narrowly defined. Within the hands-on touch professions, you can today, if you so choose to train in approximately 60 or 70 different types of touch therapeutic techniques classified as body work. Professionals with massage licenses can practice other types of body work under their license. And this is an opportunity to try to combine those two to help to define those two fairly narrowly. In no way does the Board of Massage see itself as having licensing authority over body work. It would be like herding cats, mountain lions, whatever you want to say. That would not be in the interest of the state. We're very clear that our role is to serve the state in oversight of massage therapy. But it was necessary to do this for some clarification.
And there's no opposition that you know of for this?
No, there's no opposition. The only thing I would say is that it's in the interest of the Physical Therapy Association and the Chiropractic Association not to define body work any more broadly than you see right there. Because persons in a variety of touch professions practice different types of techniques we would classify as body work.
Great. Are there any questions? President Hayden?
Chair Greenlink, my understanding is the State Board of Massage Therapists already have, if they chose to do so to under their administrative rule, to make this change and adopt it into the governance of your licensees. Why do you need to come to the legislature for that?
My understanding is that the minimum requirements are in statute and that it's up to the board then to further define that statute and rule as to what numbers of hours are in each portion of the 500, making recommendations to the Department of Education.
So
the basic statutory requirement of 500 minimum, I believe, is in statute. Yeah, that's true. And so we need a basic statutory change to elevate it to 625, and then by rulemaking, the Oregon Board would make recommendations as to how the 625 would be apportioned.
So that's on your educational requirements. How about the activity of the manipulative thrusting? Could you not just, couldn't the State Board of Massage Therapists adopt that? I mean, isn't that the process that you do?
We could adopt it, yes, sir. But in this case, we were asked by the Chiropractic Association to clearly define in statute this specific limitation.
So if I'm hearing that correctly, you have the authority to do it, but you prefer to put it in statute. Is that correct?
I believe at this time it's wise.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, committee.
Close public hearing on Senate Bill 298A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 301A. Madam Administrator.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 301A comes to you from the Senate floor with unanimous vote of 30 ayes. This defines dental hygiene to include pre-diagnostic risk assessment, specifies that unless different criteria is included in a collaborative agreement between an expanded practice dental hygienist and a dentist at least once a year, the expanded practice dental hygienist must refer a patient or resident to a dentist that is available to treat the patient. There is no fiscal impact, no revenue impact on the bill, and we have one individual signed up, and that's Alec Schiebel.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, Alec Schiebel, representing the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association. Senate Bill 301 essentially is a cleanup bill of the expanded practice dental hygienist permit statute. Under the current statute, in the collaborative agreement section, there's a requirement that the hygienists do risk assessments. That resulted in confusion in the field because all dental hygienists have been doing risk assessments. So what 301 does, the first part of 301, the change does, is it takes risk assessment out of the collaborative agreement section and moves it into the definition of dental hygiene, making it more clear for everybody that all dental hygienists do pre-diagnostic risk assessments. The second change that it does is that under the current statute, expanded practice dental hygienists must have at least one referral per year. There was some comments from the ODA that they'd like, and others, that they'd like to have that more flexible. So there may be a different experience level either or practice difference for a dentist or experience level for a dental hygienist. So what the second change for 301 does is it allows by written agreement in the collaborative agreement to agree to more than one or whatever they want to agree to, but at least one per year remains the base. So with that, we've worked with ODA and with the dental board on this and be happy to answer any questions.
No problems, sir.
No problems.
Are there any questions? I close the public hearing on House Bill on Senate Bill 301A and open the work session on Senate Bill 301A. Do I have a motion?
Chair Greenlick, I move Senate Bill 301A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hayden moves Senate Bill 301A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Yes.
Representative Clem?
Excuse.
Representative Kenner?
Aye.
Representative Kenny Geyer?
Excuse. Will you mark her excuse for all the rules?
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Weidner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Noakes?
Aye.
Chair Greenland?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Hayden, will you handle this one?
Sure. Yes.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 301A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 523A. What do we have here, Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 523A requires insurers to notify a provider that an enrollee is in a grace period when the enrollee fails to pay the premium for their qualified health plan if the provider requests information regarding coverage, eligibility, or benefits. Also requires the insurer to reimburse the provider for services performed during the grace period when the coverage is terminated if the insurer fails to notify the provider and the service is covered by the plan. This has minimal fiscal impact, no revenue. It left the Senate floor with 27 ayes and 3 noes. And we have several individuals to testify, Mr. Chair.
Let's see. Why don't you call a panel?
Okay. Courtney Dresser, Sarah Basler, and Polly DeVore.
Who else?
And then we have...
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlake and members of the committee. My name is Sarah Basler. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Nurses Association. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 523A. This piece of legislation deals with what's known as the grace period under the Affordable Care Act. The grace period is a 90-day period during which a patient who has qualified for a subsidy for a plan purchased through the exchange is technically covered by insurance even if they've fallen behind on their premium. The federal rules associated with this part of the Affordable Care Act specify that for the first 30 days of the grace period, the insurer needs to reimburse the provider for any services that occurred during that days 1 through 30. The federal rules are silent during silent about reimbursement for services that are provided to the patient during days 31 through 90, which in practicality means that it's the provider and the patient who are responsible for payment of services during that time. If the patient hasn't paid their premium by the end of the 90-day period, their coverage can be canceled. Claims that were pending during that time, then the insurer does not need to reimburse the provider. If the patient does pay their premium at or near the end of the 90 days, the insurer then has to reimburse the provider for services that were performed during that time. One of the problems that's come up with this is that when a provider tries to verify a patient's insurance coverage prior to performing services or having a patient visit, and they check with the insurance company, the way that it currently works is the insurer may just tell them that the patient is covered, making no mention of the fact that this patient is in a grace period and that the provider may not be able to receive insurance reimbursement for any services that they perform. Because the provider doesn't know about the grace period prior to seeing the patient, it's a missed opportunity for them to have a conversation with the patient about their premium being delayed or to come up with a payment plan for a patient who may be on the hook for the cost of their services. Senate Bill 523 seeks to improve this situation for providers. It's really about transparency. This bill requires that insurers, when a provider checks a patient's coverage, that if the patient is in the grace period, this would require the insurer to tell the provider that this patient is in a grace period. Again, I want to emphasize that the burden is on the provider to check that the patient is covered. If the provider doesn't seek to verify coverage, the insurer would not be required to tell the provider that there's a grace period issue. If the provider does try to verify coverage when the patient is in a grace period and the insurer doesn't tell the provider that there is a grace period issue, Senate Bill 523 would require the insurer to reimburse the provider for services during that time. In addition to representing nurses, ONA represents a number of nurse practitioners around the state. Many of them are small business owners who are going through some of the issues that I've just outlined to you. In a moment, you'll hear from Polly DeVore, who's a manager at a nurse practitioner-run clinic, and she'll tell you a bit about some of the administrative hassles and loops involved in this whole process. ONA supports this bill because it gives providers more information, and we urge your support as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Who's next?
I'm next. Chair Greenlake and members of the committee, hello, my name is Polly DeVore. I'm the director of Olive Branch Family Health. We're located in the most northeastern corner of the state in Enterprise, Oregon. And as Sarah noted,
come here all the way from Enterprise, right?
Yeah. I did.
Oh,
yes.
Thank you very much.
I'm very passionate about this. So as I was stating, Teresa Russell, she's a nurse practitioner, owns our facility. And we have all of our latest technology available to us. We invest heavily into our Athena Health and Phreesia, which is how we verify real-time folks' eligibility with their insurances. So how that works is when a patient comes and they check in, we pull up on the Phreesia pad what their insurance is, what their policy shows, whether or not they're eligible for those benefits. And there's not any way that in our facility that we can see that a patient is in a grace period time. So we're going forward showing that this patient is actually eligible for services with their benefits, full benefits. And it isn't until much later that we hear back that, well, either those claims are pended or denied for the fact that they were not eligible for services at that time with that policy.
You checked with the insurance company at that point?
Yes, real time.
You weren't given information at that point that they were suspended?
We're not given any information at our facility with that their insurance is pending, that it's during a grace period time. It shows either that they are not eligible, so that's if the policy has been completely canceled, or that they're current, meaning that they're eligible for services. There's nothing about a grace period. So with our specific system with Phreesia, there's actually even more detailed. There's green, meaning everything is great with the information we have for this patient. Go ahead, finish checking them in. There's the yellow warning triangle that says, wait a minute, there's a problem with the demographics for this patient. That could be either their address. It could be that they can't match up this patient. Maybe they moved, and so they have a new address. It'll give us those warnings real time. It will indicate if there's a problem even down to their middle initial, or perhaps a spelling of their name, or maybe there's a mismatch with dates of birth. It gives us all that information, but we don't get the information that their policy is in a grace period. And that's, we do our check-ins. The furthest ahead that we check eligibility is 2 days. So, for instance, if a patient comes in on Friday, we would have checked their eligibility, ran a report to see the patients the next day on Thursday. If I'm looking ahead at the patients for Monday, I can look at those as soon as Friday. We don't run reports on patients, say, several weeks ahead. So this is done real time. The other issue that we run into with our patients is depending on what we're seeing them for, and I'm just going to use a random example. If a person comes in, say they're having some issues with their thyroid, and the provider feels around and says, oh, there's a nodule there. Well, a standard course of care would be, okay, well, then we need to get that person's lab work, so we're doing some labs. Now we're seeing that some levels are a bit out of the norm. They're going to be ordering perhaps an ultrasound to see if what type of nodule this is looking like, what the size of that nodule is. And so at this point now, it doesn't just involve our facility, but now we're sending a referral to the facility. In our situation, it's a hospital for the ultrasound. So they're checking back with us as well. What type of insurance does this patient have? And, you know, of course, they're wanting to make sure that they're going to be getting paid. So is this person eligible? They're running their eligibility checks as well. So when this person goes through registration at the hospital, again, those things are checked. And our experience has been that we haven't been informed of a grace period, and neither has the hospital. So this person then has their ultrasound. So the ultrasound confirms that, say, it's a 1 millimeter nodule. So now there's concern they're going to biopsy.
I really do want to understand what you're saying. You don't get back any information from the insurance company?
Right now they're still eligible for services. It's still green. There's nothing indicating to us that this person is in a grace period. And so the timeline that we're looking at right now for these services, these are all things that I really want it to be clear how quickly these things escalate, because We're following up with this patient after these visits. We're getting this information back. We are seeing that, okay, now there's a problem, so we have to have a biopsy done on this as well. So now we've had our services. We've had, in addition to that, we've had lab work, which involves another facility for labs. We've had a hospital involved for the ultrasound. Now there's a biopsy. Now you're going to be referring this patient. We've seen this patient back, putting all these pieces together, now to refer that patient to a specialist. And again, we're still in this realm of grace period, but we don't know. So what happens is, in the realm of the payment and how claims go, it's 30 to 45 days, which would be a very quick turnaround of claims. And this is when you start to see these things can all happen within that time frame. And now we get these claims back saying that they're either pending or denied because they weren't eligible for services under that policy at that time. And we didn't know. And that's common.
Right. Representative Nose?
Maybe this is obvious. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But could you just state, so the consequence of us not passing this bill is what?
Well, without being overly blunt.
Please be blunt.
I really do not know how it could be expected for providers, whether it be from a small facility such as the one that I am the director of, or a larger facility as a hospital, to be able to know when a patient is paying their premiums on time or not. Our job is to provide the health care, and we're trusting that the information that we're given real time that we use to check these benefits, the eligibilities, we trust that we're given all the information. And I can't see, I simply don't understand why we can see when there's a problem with addresses, we can see when there's a problem with middle initials, we can see when there's a problem with dates of birth, but we can't see when there's a problem with eligibility.
Yes. I'm sorry.
So, go ahead.
So, maybe I'll put words in your mouth. So if we don't pass this, what it means is that if you provide services to somebody and there's some question about their insurance, is it you or the hospital that's on the hook as opposed to the insurance?
Absolutely.
Okay. No, the patient's on the hook.
Patient's on the
hook. Well, yes and no. Because what happens is if...
The patient's on the hook.
What happens is if you are fully electronic, which we are, and when we submit our claims electronically, there are all these claims rules that fire, and that's how we term it. And so when you're dealing with insurances and payers that are through the exchange, there are certain rules that you have to abide by for billing patients. Not all patients... It's not legal to bill all patients depending on what type of insurance policy they have. If it's a form of insurance that they've gotten through the exchange, but it's in our area, there's subsidized insurance and it's more through a form of Medicaid, you can't bill those patients.
That's Medicaid, but that's not...
It's Medicaid, bill, but it's not...
I understand. Let me make sure I'm correct. This bill only refers to... The 90-day period only refers to people who've bought health insurance on the exchange and are subsidized for the premium for that.
Right.
Everybody else only has a 30 days. So you're not talking about Medicaid people here.
No.
You're talking about privately insured people.
But I'm talking about the rules that fire. So coming back to the electronic piece of it... When you come back to those claims rules, they'll go into a hold pattern because of this other piece. Because when you have through the exchange, you do have, it is a separate type of insurance. And no, it isn't Medicaid. But you have these rules that then you have to do claims notes to identify that, no, this is not actually part of the Medicaid program, but because it has gone through the exchange, because both of them tie into that electronically. It's just how those insurance claims function, or at least with our system it does, with Athena Health?
The answer the representative knows this question is the patient is at risk and owes the money at that point. Sometimes you can't collect it, so you have a bad debt problem. Things
right, like you have a bad debt.
The patient is on the hook. Yep.
You can bill the patient, but the hospital or the providers are the ones that are on the hook.
Let's move on and get the panel done, and then we can ask these questions. I have a basic question you need to get ready for is, I know the next panel is going to propose a five-day requirement. It would be useful if you tell us why, since you always do it in 2 days, being required to do it within 5 business days is a problem, I suspect. We've talked, so I know it is.
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, for the record, Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association, and I wanted just the details of the bill are in front of you. You've heard why we brought this forward. So through our work with the American Medical Association and other states, we kind of were made aware of the situation early last year as these rules were being adopted at the federal level. We did approach the insurers early last year saying this is something we need to probably be looking at. We didn't receive a lot of solutions or suggestions, and we continue to move forward. We met again with the insurers in July, and again, didn't get a lot of feedback, but we just kept moving forward, partnering with the ONA. We met with the insurers on the Senate side, and that's how you got 523A. There's some compromises that were made on the Senate side, and as you know, it passed the Senate with 27 votes. I think the other issue is that this issue is being addressed in different states, and most of these states are seeing the same kind of language in the bill. Both Louisiana and Washington State have passed bills similar to ours that provide notification to providers prior to the service being performed. And we would just, again, like to thank our partner, the ONA, and the sponsors of the bill for all of their help on this as we continue to get this through this session and through this state.
Representative Bueller, you had a question?
No, I don't.
Where's Representative Bueller? Did you have a question?
I have a couple of questions. Did you want me to wait till after?
No, this is fine. Okay. I wanted to finish the whole panel.
So thank you, Chair Greenlee, and just comment, today is a nice Wednesday, and it is the first time I sit on a committee in the majority for the moment until Clem shows up.
See if you can do anything with it.
See if I can do it. Touche.
Actually, it's a tie.
It's a tie.
It's as close as we.
Well, one,
Bill,
two, three.
And I'm our leftist.
Thank you.
Anyway, I do have a couple of questions on this bill, and thank you for the time speaking with you the other day. I've been over the bill, read through it pretty carefully. On Section 2, Part 2, Line 20 through 23, it talks about if the healthcare provider requests the eligibility information. I'm fairly familiar with how that process goes. But my concern here with this is it really doesn't spell out. Is it assumed or is it somewhere else that that's an electronic or a traceable request versus a phone call? Is it pretty hard to prove a phone call?
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, Representative Hayden, the intent is that all practices that currently take place would remain the same. So how they do it now, how Polly or any of the practice managers do it now to verify eligibility would continue. What would happen is they would receive the same information back. No, everything would remain the same, except there would be one additional piece of information on the insurer's side. And that would be if that patient's in the grace period.
The answer to your question is it could include a phone call.
It could be a phone call.
It could be a phone call.
Which I could see that as problematic. Second and third question, Chair Greenlee. Under urgent and emergency care, you're proposing 2 days prior to the patient shows up, but, you know, mom's got to get baby in right away. Rushes down there, shows up at the office. The pediatrician is going to see the patient. How does this bill address that?
Chair Greenlee, members of the committee, we're not proposing any changes to 523A, so I just wanted to be clear. So your question about emergent care would be provided no matter what, and the issue of if they're covered or not covered would be taken care of. If it's an emergent situation, would be taken care of after the service, just like it would be now.
Sure.
If you're talking the child, the infant, the timing would be when they got insurance. If you're talking about the mother, again, if it was an emergent situation, we would deal with the coverage later.
I'm really speaking to the timing of, is 48 hours enough time for the insurance company to realistically get back to you before an urgent care appointment? We're not talking about an immediate emergency, mm-hmm. but something that is urgent, needs to be taken care of quickly. The healthcare provider picks up the phone, calls the insurance company, says, is this patient covered under this bill? It looks like if you see that patient the next day, then the insurance company would be required to cover that if they hadn't got back to you within a 24-hour period of time or something like that. Is that correct?
I don't believe we have timelines in here. When we ask, they would provide the information back to us that they know at that time. To be clear, we are not seeking the insurance company to tell us something that might happen in the future. We're asking them to tell us something that they know at that time if we ask. Hmm. If we ask, tell me what you know right then. That's all they can do.
Follow up. Yes. So I understand that. What I'm asking is the time between the ask and the time between the response, the way I read the bill, does not seem to be defined.
Chair Greenlick, Representative Hayden, as a reminder, under federal law, the first 30 days of this grace period is covered. So under your situation, if I asked and I was told that they are eligible and not in the grace period and performed a service 4 days later, and on that fourth day they happen to then reach that grace period and they're on day three of it, it wouldn't matter because the first 30 days are covered.
Still not my question, though. Question is, the provider asks for the information.
They get it back really fast.
How long does the insurance company have to respond to that information?
What they currently do now, however it is done now. We're not asking for a change in that response rate.
Okay.
But I want you to know, if you will, just, and we have to go, we have a bunch of bills, and we have another group. They are going to come in and propose that they're willing to do what you want, as long as your request is within 5 days of the 5 business days of the actual appointment. So they are willing to say, if you ask within 5 business days and we tell you they're eligible or we don't give you the information you need, they'll pay for the claim. You have a problem with that. That amendment's coming, and I would like to know if you have a problem with that amendment, and if so, why?
Go ahead. Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, we've had a number of conversations with the insurers about potential amendments. One of the concerns seems to be that a provider might try to check coverage long before a visit, before there's a grace period issue, and then by the time the visit occurs, there's a grace period issue. We think the bill is clear as written and would be willing to further clarify that we would only expect the insurer to tell the provider of a grace period issue if there is a grace period issue. I'm not sure what compelling reason there would be to put 5 days in. I don't believe there's a for non-grace period issues. I'm not sure.
Here you say, and I've heard you say before, the pattern is you do it within 2 days or 3 days. So all they're asking for is if you do it within 5 business days, which is a week, they'll cover it if they say they're covered. Why is that not a legitimate compromise?
Chair Greenlink, members of the committee, I think we're very willing to continue the conversation. We would like to, I think, better understand why the 5 days is needed.
Okay. You have a...
Just to follow up, Chair, when we have asked them to provide us some information of why 5 days, Y2, Y3, Y5, they weren't able to give us any of that data to see that this is a problem. Are we having problems now? Are providers not getting eligibility requirements, checking requirements now? And at this point, that we just don't see the data.
Obviously, problem. That's why you have a bill.
Yes, but the problem is on the transparency of knowing the information, not when we request the information.
Okay, well, let's call the next panel, please.
Okay. We have Tom Holt, Elise Brown, Marion Blankenship.
I'm going to ask you to be brief. Brief, succinct, compelling. And the answer is going to be whatever you say. I'm going to ask you guys to go away and get this thing fixed.
Could be otherwise.
Well, good afternoon.
If that saves you any time, that would be good.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Elise Brown for AHIP, the National Trade Association, America's Health Insurance Plans. And thanks very much for the opportunity to let us be here and comment on Senate Bill 523. And just up front, we appreciate the opportunity to sit down with the proponents. They passed the bill out of the Senate, and it included comments from us, and we were thankful that we have the opportunity to continue the discussion, and we hope to do that. In a minute, one of my AHIP members will go into a little bit of detail about the Dash 5 amendments that we would ask for your consideration. But let me also just restate again for the record that the importance and relevance that HHS has put on the whole idea of the 90-day grace period, and its target audience really was those that are using subsidies in the exchange. So they did weigh whether or not the carriers, the enrollees, through increased premiums or providers should bear the financial risk during the grace period. And ultimately, they determined that carriers should for the first month, as you heard, and the provider for the second and third month. And this approach was to strike an appropriate balance. And again, due to the concerns about premium increases, if the carriers paid all three months, then the tax liability changes. Again, the tax liability is changing for those who are using subsidies in the exchange. So the notice requirement was created to advise providers of the status of the individual's coverage, but it wasn't intended to place the insurers on the hook for covering the cost when we haven't received the premium. So Senate Bill 523, in our minds and eyes, still goes beyond what the ACA's original intent was, because it's shifting the burden on the insurers. Shifting the burden on the insurers is going to shift the cost. Again, we would be paying for services when we haven't received premium. So everybody ultimately pays for that. I will pass it along to my AHIP members for further discussion. I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. I think we're all in violent agreement that the ACA rules have created a bit of a mess around this issue. But just to give you a little flavor where we are, these rules came out last year, I think all carriers that I know of are working on getting our systems to a place of automation where a provider like the Olive Branch Family Health Clinic can go online and get a signal that this person is in the grace period. Today, we don't have that capability, and what we do is we call the provider when we catch in our system that someone's been pinged that is in that grace period, then an outbound call goes out so that the provider is aware. And if a provider were to call us, and some do, they get what we know as of that moment. The issue here is, and we agree that, if we tell the provider that this person is eligible for coverage, that they're, as far as we know, they're current, they've followed a good practice of checking. We've given them our best information. They're acting in a reasonable way then to proceed, and it does seem reasonable that we be on the hook to pay for that. The concern we have with the bill as it now stands is that we think it needs just a little bit more work, and it's around this question of when should the provider need to check. We have suggested 5 business days. That's basically a week. And the concern we have is not with the good providers like those who were just up here, but any time there is something created in statute, or if we've done a sloppy job on a contract, for someone to be able to exploit getting funds, unfortunately, there's a small percentage out there that will do it. And so what we're trying to avoid here is the situation where, say, a surgery or some other, you know, planned procedure is on the calendar, you know, a month or 2 months out, and then a couple of premium billing cycles go by and somebody stops paying their premium. We don't want to be on the hook for paying for claims for someone who has decided to stop paying for their insurance when they know they're going to have a procedure done that's very costly. So our suggestion is 5 business days. We think most providers check much closer than that. I think we heard that just a few minutes ago. Yeah, we just think that would be a good sideboard if we're going to get into legislating what I think is going to be a business problem that's getting solved this year largely by IT work at many plans, including ours. But in the meantime, you know, the providers have a legitimate gripe here. We share their frustration, and we'd like to get this bill to a place that we can all be very enthusiastically supportive.
Good afternoon, for the record. My name is Marian Blankenship with Pacific Source. Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, I really am just here to echo and play a little bit of sweeper with my colleagues. I think it's really clear that we do have a little bit of a mess that we've all inherited as part of the Affordable Care Act, and what is really a fairly murky 60 days. I agree with Elise. I think that the ACA grace period notice requirement is really pretty explicit, and that is that it is our responsibility to certainly alert providers when we know that a member is in the grace period. But the notion of actually shifting the cost over to carriers, I don't think that was what was envisioned. And so I think it just is it's a little bit of a slippery slope. That said, I mean, I think that the earlier testimony was pretty compelling, and I think it's very frustrating. I know that currently Pacific Source, echoing Tom, we're in the process of trying, where there has been a lot of back-end work, quite frankly, going into implementation of all the different elements of the ACA. So currently, through our portal, you can get some basic information relative to when the plan becomes effective, but you can't get grace period information. When we see that a member has sort of pinged into the grace period, we will reach out, but that is a hit-and-miss process. We don't have some kind of internal trigger system at this point that just immediately alerts us. When providers call us, we absolutely will quote what we see relative to the grace period. And so I think that the language that we're proposing, it, you know, I think that it helps to standardize a reasonable process. And I think that that's part of the frustration, I would imagine, on the part of providers, is that there is perhaps not sort of a uniformity in the way that they're being expected to approach it, and then carriers in turn. So we just support the notion of the amendment that is coming to you, and hope that you'll consider it. Thanks.
I'm going to close this hearing. I'm going to ask you guys to go work it out. If not, we'll pass one form or another, but my preference would be you come back and say, we're okay where we are. So I'm going to ask the proponents and you guys to see if you can work out the problem. It seems to me you're very close. Thank you for testifying.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 523A and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 626. I'm waiting for 662. I'm waiting for the rest of the committee to be here so we can work some bills. This is a brief one, I think.
Yes.
Mr. Chair. What do we have?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 662 requires that a dental instructor's license issued to a specialist be restricted to the specialty for which the applicant completed their advanced dental education program, removes the reference to the accreditation of dental programs. What you have in front of you is a dash one amendment. I'm sorry, we had the twos, now we're onto the ones. that the dash one clarifies that a dental instructor's either be a graduate of an accredited dental school or has a certificate or degree showing successful completion of an advanced dental education program.
From an accredited school of dentistry.
No, from an advanced.
Yeah. From an advanced.
From, it has an advanced certificate from an accredited dental school. I think. Well, let's call the witness and we'll get it straight.
Correct.
Down.
This left the Senate floor unamended with 30 ayes. There is no revenue, no fiscal impact. We have Jeffrey Stewart and George O'Coolidge.
Good afternoon. Chair Greenlick and members of the House Health Care Committee, my name is Dr. Jeffrey Stewart. I am a faculty member at the OHSU School of Dentistry, and I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 662. Senate Bill 662 changes one word in the statute relating to dental instructor licensing so that the Oregon Board of Dentistry can issue a faculty license to dentists who earn an advanced degree from an accredited dental school. The way the statute is currently written, the Oregon Board of Dentistry can only issue a faculty license to a dentist who earned their degree from an accredited program within an accredited school. Perhaps I can clarify the reason that there's some a little difficulty with the current language. This problem actually came to light when OHSU hired a dentist faculty member with an advanced degree in oral medicine from the University of Washington, which is one of the premier oral medicine programs in the United States. The University of Washington School of Dentistry is fully accredited, but the oral medicine program was not accredited separately because the Commission on Dental Accreditation was not accrediting oral medicine programs separately at the time of this dentist's graduation from their program. These types of programs are accredited along with the general accreditation of the entire dental school program. This means that based on the current wording of the statute in question, the Oregon Board of Dentistry cannot grant her a faculty license to practice at the dental school. This one word change would allow the Oregon Board of Dentistry to issue faculty licenses to dentists who earn their advanced degree from a program in an accredited dental school, even if the program within the school is not separately accredited. We would also like to note OHSU's support for the Dash 1 amendments that were requested by the Oregon Board of Dentistry. This language does more clearly articulate that an applicant must have completed the advanced degree to be issued the faculty license. Thank you, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
George, you have a hand.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. For the record, my name is George O'Coolidge, here on behalf of the Oregon Dental Association. We're here to ask your support of Senate Bill 662 with the Dash 1 Amendment. We in Oregon here are incredibly fortunate to have a brand new dental school facility in our state, and this new building has created a place where dental students can learn and provide patient care in a modern state-of-the-art setting. And if you haven't been up there, I would encourage each and every one of you during the interim to contact OHSU and get a tour of the new building. The School of Dentistry plays an important role in fulfilling the oral health needs of Oregon citizens and graduate some of the best clinically trained dentists in the entire nation. In addition to being a place where students and faculty provide important treatment to fellow Oregonians, the school is a nationally recognized dental research facility and is a sponsor for dental continuing education.
All right, Senate that's Bill. Enough commercial.
I'll go. All right, Senate Bill 662 modifies the current language regarding the dental instructor's license issued by the State Board of Dentistry. I can repeat some of what Dr. Stewart was saying, but, you know, I'll let him do the description. I know you're rushed today, so.
Are there any questions? Okay, thank you very much. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 662 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 662. Do I have an amendment?
Yes, you do, Mr. Chair. I would like to move that the committee adopt the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 662 dated May 12, 2015.
Representative Nose moves the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 662 dated 5-12-15. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? So moved.
Take another motion, Mr.
Yep,
Chair?
Yep, I would.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move Senate Bill 662 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves Senate Bill 662 to the floor with a due pass as amended with a dash on amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Is there any objection? Call the roll.
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Clint?
Aye.
Representative
Kettimer? Aye.
Representative
Lively?
Aye.
Representative Weiner?
Aye. Vice
Chair Hayden? Aye. Vice Chair Nose? Aye. Chair Greenlight? Aye. Motion carries. Representative Hayden will carry it on the floor. I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 662. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 153. Madam Administrator, will you remind us where we are on this?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 153 had a hearing on May 6th. At that time, we had the Dash 1 amendment before us. This left the Senate floor 29 ayes, 1 no. You'll recall that this clarifies for the insurance reimbursement of primary care mental health services by physician assistants and certified nurse practitioners in independent practice. This clarifies the definition for the purposes of that reimbursement. The Dash 1 amendment provides additional criteria for the reimbursement for nurse practitioners and the PAs. You do have a fiscal statement on the Dash 1, which is similar to the fiscal statement on the original bill, and no revenue impact, Mr. Chair.
I have a motion.
Susan, I know the date of the Dash 1 amendment, Mr. Chair. You ready?
I am ready.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I would like to move that the committee adopt for Senate Bill 153, the Dash 1 amendment dated May 5th, 2015.
Representative Nose moves the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 153 dated 5/5/15. Is there any discussion on the amendment? Is there any objection? So moved.
Second another motion, Mr. Chair?
I'd love one.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 153 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves Senate Bill 153 as amended with a Dash 1 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Please call the roll.
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Kettimer?
Aye.
Representative
Lively? Aye.
Representative Weidner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenlight?
Aye. Motion carries. The carrier volunteer?
I will, Mr. Chair.
Senator Lively will carry it. Close the work session. Yep. On Senate Bill 153.
Any amendment?
Nope. Senator, is 227 okay? Open a work session on Senate Bill 227. Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 227 had a public hearing on April 27th. It allows the Director of the Emergency Medical Services and Trauma Registry Program within the Oregon Health Authority to adopt rules establishing a registry of brain injury trauma information, establishes that individually identifiable information may be released to OHA to administer public health programs. It establishes the individually identified information, also can be released to DHS, Department of Human Services, to plan and provide services to the individuals adversely affected by the trauma injuries. There's no fiscal impact, no revenue impact, no amendment, Mr. Chair.
Can I have a motion?
Chair Greenlick, I move Senate Bill 227 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hayden moves Senate Bill 227 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Would you please call the roll?
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Clinton?
Aye.
Representative Kettimer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Weidner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenlick?
Aye. The motion carries. Senate Bill 227 is on the way to the floor. We have a carrier.
Okay.
What was the work session on Senate Bill 227? Open up work session on Senate Bill 229. What do we got, Madam Administrator?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 229 requires members of the Consumer Advisory Council to be compensated and reimbursed by the Oregon Health Authority for performing their duties of the council. The Consumer Advisory Council advises the Health Authority Director on mental health services, on provisions of the current mental health services. There is a fiscal statement, but at this time it's indeterminate just because of the stipend and the expense reimbursement. No revenue impact, no amendment, Mr. Chair.
Do we have a motion?
Chair Greenlick, I move Senate Bill 229 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hayden moves Senate Bill 229 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
I think this is an important thing with mental health services becoming hopefully more and more prominent as needed in our community, that we have people that are able to come from particularly Eastern Oregon to engage in that communication, as we heard from people testifying today, coming from far areas in our state takes time and money, and so I think it's a reasonable thing that will help engage the entire state rather than just part of it.
Any other discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Hunt?
Aye.
Representative Kenner?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Weidner?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. The motion carries. Senate Bill 229 is on its way to the floor. Can I have a volunteer? Representative Nose?
Sure.
Representative Nose will carry Senate Bill 229. Close the work session on Senate Bill 229. Is everything okay? Let's move on for a moment. Let's move on.
Oh, you're just going to
We can come back.
Okay. So we're jumping to 280.
I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 280.
Getting rescheduled.
Okay. I'll come back. And Senate Bill 280A. Madam Administrator?
I know, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to make sure I have all my current papers on file.
Yep.
Senate Bill 280A changes the Board of Medical Imaging, the 12-member composition. It specifies that one must be a licensed physician who is a radiologist in good standing. Specifies three must be licensed physicians in good standing, and five must be actively engaged medical imaging licensees. Requires that if the board cannot fill the physician spots, the governor may appoint any combination of the following, and it identifies that combination. What you have before you is an A7. You might recall that at the public hearing that was on April 29th, you mentioned using retired physicians, so folks had worked together to get that amendment. That is the A7 that's before you, which allows the governor to appoint retired physicians to the board if they have not been retired for more than 6 years, who are currently registered with the Oregon Medical Board as a retired emeritus physician, or who has notified the board of retirement and is in good standing. We have a minimal fiscal impact on the A7, no revenue impact on the A7, Mr. Chair.
Do I have a motion?
Yes, you do.
Mr. Let's have it.
All right, Mr. Chair, I would like to move that we adopt the dash A7 amendments to Senate Bill 280-A, dated May 13th, 2015.
Representative Nose moves the dash A7 amendments to Senate Bill 280-A, dated 5-13-15. Is there any discussion on the amendment? It seemed to me, I requested that amendment, it was because they were having trouble filling it with active physicians, and I thought this might be something a newly retired physician might enjoy doing. So, any objection to the A7? So moved. Do I have a motion on the bill?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that we send Senate Bill 280A to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves Senate Bill 280A as amended with the A7 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Clement?
Aye.
Representative
Kenema? Aye.
Representative
Lively? Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenland?
Aye. The motion carries 280 is on the way to the floor. Representative Buehler, will you carry that?
Sure.
Close the work session on Senate Bill 280A. And we have an amendment that solves the problem.
Yeah, dash 4 amendment. Yeah.
Dash 4 solves the problem. Okay. Going to open a work session on Senate Bill 474A. No, 474. And do we have an amendment on that bill?
We do, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 474 permits existing dental clinics for special needs children to be operated by charitable corporations that specify, declares an emergency effective on passage. What you have is before you is the Dash 4 amendment dated 5-6-15 that clarifies that a clinic or program has to be at an existing single fixed location or one or more mobile locations. Senate Bill 474 left the Senate unamended, 29 ayes, one excused. There is no fiscal impact, no revenue impact on the Dash 4, Mr. Chair.
The Dash 4.
Correct.
And I have a motion.
Chair Greenlick, I move the Dash 4 amendment dated 5-6-15 to House Bill 474, Senate Bill 474.
Representative Hayden moves the Dash 4 amendments. We add it to Senate Bill 474 dated 5-6-15. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection? A4s are included in Senate Bill 474A. 474.
Chair Greenlick, I move Senate Bill 474 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hayden moves Senate Bill 474 to the floor as amended with the Dash 4s for the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenlight?
Aye. Motion carries. Carrier? Representative Hayden, please carry 474.
Yes, sir.
Close the work session on 474. Open the work session on Senate Bill 520. What do we have here?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 520 had a public hearing last week, May the 6th, permits pharmacists to administer vaccines to individuals at least 7 years of age. There's no amendment. Left the Senate floor with 30 ayes. Minimal fiscal impact. No revenue impact, Mr. Chair.
All right. Do I have a motion on Senate Bill 520?
Chair Greenlick, I move Senate Bill 520 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Hayden moves Senate Bill 520 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Could you please call the roll?
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Clem?
Aye.
Representative Kenemer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenland?
Aye. Motion carries.
Consent. Do you want consent?
Mr. Widener, would you carry this one?
Yeah.
Okay. Representative Widener.
And you're on a short carry, isn't it?
Well, we're all pretty short. No, just be respectful while you're being short.
I will say what it does and not use sign language.
There you go. I close the work session on Senate Bill 520. And let's see. Do we have everything on the back page now?
Yeah, everything on the back page.
We're holding over 233. I mean, we're rescheduling 233, and we're rescheduling
230. You mean
505?
I'm sorry.
Excuse me.
233.
Yes.
And 505.
Right.
So hold on a minute. Let's go back to the other side.
233. I want to try and carry it. They're okay if you want.
Yep.
This is the one you skipped over.
Yep.
You ready to do it?
Ready.
Okay.
Going to open a work session on Senate Bill 230A. I'm also going to do that. That massage therapy one too.
Oh, okay. Okay. Sorry. 230A. Mr. Chair had a public hearing April 29th. Specifies and requires healthcare workers to submit demographic, education, and other information to the healthcare workforce regulatory boards. Specifies that an individual submit the information when renewing a license with the appropriate board. Directs Oregon Health Authority to maintain the information. And it deletes the Office for Oregon Health Policy and Research. Requires OHA to collaborate with each board to adopt appropriate rules on the demographics and information to be included.
What did you say it deleted?
The Office of Health Policy, Oregon Health Policy and Research.
What?
Hold on.
I don't need it anymore.
Does it?
Let's stand at ease for a moment.
They're in the back. Do you want her to come up?
There's like eight employees who just lost their jobs frequently.
It doesn't delete the office.
The reference to from OHPR to the Oregon Health Authority, because it's our Office of Health Analytics who works most directly with the data coming from this data collection effort.
Okay.
It switched it from Uber to OHA as far as housing the information.
Yep.
Excellent. All right. Thank you very much. All right, do I have a motion?
We have an A2 amendment, Mr. Chair.
Really?
Yes. The A2 amendment deletes the agency's exemption status from the public contracting code.
Yeah. You ready?
I'm ready.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion that we adopt the dash A2 amendments dated April 30, 2015, to Senate Bill 230A.
Representative Nose moves the dash A2 amendments, Senate Bill 230A, dated 430. Is there any discussion? Would you get more specific about what that amendment does?
Mr. Chair, we had there's...
Here, pretty.
No, it's. Leadership has been attempting to stay consistent and create some continuity. Therefore, they've been looking at requiring OHA. Several of the statutes for OHA have exemption status from the public contracting code. They want everybody to be consistent, and so we're taking that exemption out as it rises in bills.
Okay, great.
So that's what that is. So
right.
Housekeeping.
Sounds like a good idea.
Any objection to that motion?
A2's too late.
Added to
object.
You can object now.
I'm not objecting.
We have another motion.
Partner's distracting me, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I would never do such a thing.
I've heard
him say he objected twice, though.
I'm going to be careful not to censure Representative Widener for his behavior.
I just sit down here and smile, Mr. Chair.
Representative Nose.
Yes, I'd like to make a motion, Mr. Chair.
Well, we're all still sane.
Until Representative Widener interrupts me, I would like to move that we send Senate Bill 230A to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Nose moves Senate Bill 230A as amended with the dash A2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Even with Representative Nose's objections, I'm still going to support this bill and vote yes on it.
I think that's a really good idea because it's not a trivial bill. We're joking on it, but the fact is we really need to have this kind of information about who people are and where they practice. And we heard some things about rural and urban that we didn't get very good answers, so this might be very helpful.
I do have just a quick comment here. Make sure I'm understanding this right. On the -2A amendment, it says we're deleting dietitians and State Board of Massage Therapists from that information. Am I reading that? Am I in the right place here? Did I get two bills mixed up here?
230, we're on page 3.
H3, the English, 19. Leading line 20 and 21, right?
Right, are you on the A version of the bill?
I believe so.
But you're on page 3, not page 1.
Okay, sorry.
I have to say, I just got a text message from Representative Kenny Geyer, who's watching us, saying we should behave.
Okay.
So
okay.
It's
okay.
Right here for the purposes, and then those last.
I think it was me. Okay. She was.
Send her a message that we love her and miss her.
Okay. Sorry. Yeah, I'm good.
Call the roll, please.
Representative Buehler?
Yes.
Representative Klein?
Aye.
Representative Ketterer?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative
Widener?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hayden?
Aye.
Vice Chair Nose?
Aye.
Chair Greenlee?
Aye. The motion carries. Do I have a carrier?
I'll carry this one.
Representative Nose will carry House Bill 230A. Close the work session. I mean, Senate Bill. Close the work session on Senate Bill 230A. And we're going back up to the high velocity.
Vote no more for it.
Well, if you object when you're carrying it.
Actually, I can find out what this is.
Okay. We'll carry over or we'll reschedule Senate Bill 238A for a work session probably next Monday or so. I'm sorry, 298A.
There is no
238. All right, let's take a moment and see if there's anything else I need to do.
I think that's it.
I think it is, because you need 662. We're waiting for an amendment on 523, 298.
It's actually what? The difference between the
Representative Nose, you want to go through the list?
Yeah, that's not a bad idea.
Actually.
Let's go through the list. Let's start from the top.
298 had a public hearing. We're rescheduling the work session.
All right.
301, we had the public hearing, and it moved out of committee with a due pass.
Thank you.
523A had the public hearing. We're waiting for the amendment and the discussion, so that will be a reschedule for the work session. 662, we had the public hearing, adopted the -1, and moved it out of committee.
Right.
And Rep. Hayden is carrying it. And then our work sessions, 153.
152 is the first one, right? Isn't it?
No, 153.
Oh, all right.
Moved. 227 moved. 229 moved. 230 moved. 233 is a reschedule. 280 with the A7s moved.
474
moved. And then 474
moved
mm-hmm. with the -4s. 505 is a reschedule. Yeah. And then 520 moved as is.
Okay.
So I think we completed our agenda for today.
Good job. Wow. Okay. Please, again, try and be here on time. We have a long, long agenda for Friday, is that right?
Yes, and those will all be public hearings. They're all public hearings.
And possible work sessions.
Right, so.
Okay. We are adjourned.
You sign in.
We are adjourned.
You sign in.